So yeah, I'm talking today to Bjorn, who is the founder of Ivy Leads. And thanks for joining me, Bjorn. I thought it'd be interesting to have a chat. And hopefully you've got some insights that we can talk about, particularly related to your background in design. And it'll be great to talk about what you're doing with Ivy Leads as well. So yeah, thanks for joining.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Ed. I'm excited to be part of this series. I've been following it the last couple of weeks, and I think it's a great little podcast you guys got. And so I was excited to be part of this.
Thanks. Yeah, that's really cool. So maybe you could just start by talking a bit about your background. I would love to hear like how you got into what you're doing now and what you were doing before Ivy Leads.
Sure. I grew up in Germany. I went to school there, studied computer science. I studied a little bit of design. I guess in America, you would call it like a minor in design and a major in computer science.
Okay, yeah, we really don't understand that major minor thing over here.
Yeah. Yeah. So, after school, I went to America and I actually landed in Texas first, where I had my first job, I think at Match.com, big dating site. Which was great. A lot of people at the time were starting to tell people to like not worry about big companies and go do the startup thing. I think it must have been like 2009 or 2010, somewhere around that. And I went out to California shortly before I was starting at Match, and I participated in this thing called Y Combinator Startup School. It was pretty novel then. It was very small compared to what it is these days. It was at Stanford University, a little auditorium, maybe a couple of hundred people that showed up there. Y Combinator wasn't as big of a thing as it is these days, but it still had some traction and people started to know it within the tech community. So that just kind of like made me realize that there's other people out there that do, you know, side projects and try to build companies and that are looking for other ways than just, you know, do a 9-to-5 for the rest of their life. So on the way back from, you know, trying to figure out what to do next, I still thought it was a good idea to work at Match and kind of see what the end result looks like. Like, what does a big tech company look like from the inside and maybe learn some of their processes. And I would still highly advise people go do this right after college. I think startups are great in making you think quick on your feet. But like when it comes to process, like nothing is better than like seeing something that already works. Even if it's not like the perfect thing, it just kind of gives you some idea to, you know, why product managers are the way they are, why designers are the way they are. Just in general, like it teaches you a little bit about how the world works. So I did that for about 2 years or so. And then a couple of my friends, they gotten into YC, so they really wanted me to join and help them build the SaaS app called UserFox. UserFox was a retention as a service play. It would basically allow you to set up some smart rules around your welcome emails. So you could, collect some data on your users and then say, day one, you get a welcome email. Day two, if you still haven't upgraded on day two, you will get this email. If you have upgraded, you will get a different email. It was kind of a clever little thing, and it was acquired by AdRoll in San Francisco about 18 months in. So it wasn't a huge success, but it was something that really kind of pushed me from consumer into enterprise, and I really liked that space, so I kind of stuck to that.
Okay, that's interesting. I think, yeah, there is something there around the jump from consumer to enterprise. I think for a lot of people, it's well, certainly for me, it was never an intention to do. It just kind of happened. Mm-hmm. I'm interested. Obviously, your background at Match is kind of relevant given their recent IPO. What did you learn there? What were you actually doing with them?
Well, if I go back to that time when I first showed up at Match, I was like this young guy that just, you know, was coding a lot. And you go from this bedroom hacker type where you're by yourself cranking out some some piece of MVP that you want to maybe ship or share with your friends. And then when you go to something bigger like Match or a Yahoo or a Facebook, you have to really learn how to be professional. Like, you have to work within a team. You have to deal with stuff where you can't freely decide that you're going to go this route or that you're going to pick this library or that you're going to do this. Like, there's a certain, it's just a different way. And at first it was kind of like, you would react to it as like, oh, I would get this done so much faster if I would just be doing the way I work at home, right? But when you're part of an organization, there's actually some reason behind why things are a certain way, and that you can't like freely just take some stuff off the shelf that might have security flaws or, you know, it's not battle tested. And it's just, you know, the experience you gain by being part of a larger group and doing work that relies on other people's work and other people will rely on your results. It's just, it makes it much more complex, and you really start to understand that building software products has a lot to do with working with people and like people management and just, you know, getting people to work towards a common goal. And if it all works out nicely, then you have a really powerful machine that can crank out really solid products.
Yeah, it makes sense. So how did you end up going from there? You made the jump into enterprise. What's the kind of gap between there and founding your own business?
You mean like going from being part of an enterprise startup and then doing your own?
Yeah. What made you make that jump? Was that always the intention, or did it just kind of happen?
Yeah, pretty much. Like from high school on, I always toyed around with projects on the side, and at some point I had like a web design studio that I was running, like 2-3 guys just doing some service business style consulting and doing websites and other things back in the early 2000s. So I always had this urge to like found a company and do some stuff. I just wasn't sure, you know, growing up in Germany, that's not really something you do. Like, a lot of people will tell you, at least back then, they would tell you like, no, you have to go work for like SAP or you have to go at Siemens, and you're just this big company guy. It's just, the culture is very similar to like what you would think of in Japan, right?
Yeah.
And that's recently changed. Like, the last 5 years have been great for the Berlin scene, at least judging it from the outside. But, you know, after arriving in America, I just felt like so free to do whatever I wanted to do. So I figured, you know, I made it here, might as well go all the way, go to Silicon Valley and see if I could at least be part of a young company. I never really thought I could make my own company until I was like behind the curtain in the valley, and I worked with, you know, investors like Kleiner Perkins, Google Ventures, and I started to realize that all these other successful people have a very similar background, you know, with toying on the side in college with things, and then eventually to take this into a more professional manner. So
yeah,
I took a lot of time to like make the jump, right? Like, after the YC experience, I went to another early stage security company and helped build that. So a lot of people thought I should have found it then, but I just felt like I needed a couple of more years to like just see how this works.
Okay. And then eventually, somewhere along the lines, you made the jump. Is Ivy Leeds your first business that you founded?
It's actually my second business, but it's the first product-focused business. Before Ivy Leeds, I had this, like I mentioned earlier, this design agency thing where we just did project work. And eventually that agency also had a small little product that it tried to get off the ground. It was very similar to Kyle Bragger's Forest, where you could post work that you do. And that wasn't going many places at the time. I just didn't have the resources. I was pretty young, and I wasn't in the valley, and the funding climate wasn't attractive. So I just kind of kept sticking to doing contract work.
Okay, so where does the design part come from here? Like, you were running essentially like a design agency, but was design always one of your interests as well?
Yeah, basically. Going through college, like, I just always had this natural talent to like pick something that looks good, right? And then I would dive into this and craft skill around that. Like, I just came to the conclusion that if you have taste, then you're probably got a leg up over other people. And then I dove into like Photoshop and tried to do graphics for like a 2D game, role playing game at the time. And then eventually that will move into doing graphics for web design and apps. And that's kind of how I ended up not only doing code, but doing pixels as well.
Okay. Do you think the combination of computer science engineering combined with design is something that is pretty powerful? I see they're kind of a rare breed, these designers / engineers, and I think they people tend to jump on them when they're free to do work, and to me it seems like a very powerful combination. What do you think about that?
Yeah, it really takes a lot of hours to get both into a state where you could charge people for this. And it's basically taken me, I don't know, 10, 15 years to get there. And it is very, very powerful. Like, I've never been struggling to find work or things to do, right? Like, there's always a need for those kinds of people. But what people have to understand, like, it is a little bit BS to be a full stack engineer and also a full stack designer. Like, For instance, I am terrible at doing illustrations. Like, if you needed a really kick-ass illustration, then I'm not your guy. But I'm really good at UX. I'm really good at UI, and I'm somewhat okay doing icons. And on the same spectrum with code, like, I'm a decent engineer. I'm really good at the front end. Obviously, that's where it all comes together, right? That's where the rubber and glue meet. And I do a fair amount of back-end work, but if you were looking for somebody to write you some crazy algorithm that will do artificial intelligence stuff, then I would probably struggle a little bit. So I basically picked a certain part of the stack, which is usually database to pixel, that I focus on. And when it comes to like neural networks and things, like, I have interest in that. I know the basics of things like that, but it's not really something I am good at right now. So,
sure. Yeah, I think for me as well. I mean, also having a background in computer science, if you asked me to implement a neural network, I think I'd have to go back to my papers and resources from back then, because it's the kind of thing that you tend to either be a specialist in that area, I think, or you don't kind of have any contact with it at all. So just jumping forwards then to Ivy Leeds, so maybe you could just give a quick pitch or explain what it is and how you or why you built it.
Yeah, absolutely. Ivy Leeds is very straightforward. It's sales software that helps you grow your business. It's something that I wanted to have when we were doing UserFox. We were like this small team of three guys, and we were a SaaS app, so you naturally have a lot of signups come through. And then I noticed that we had signups that are, you know, like maybe some guy just looking into it. I'm sure you guys have similar data on your end right now, where you have a lot of people just curious. They sign up. You don't really need to pursue them on a sales route, but then you might have somebody sign up like Uber, right? And Uber, up and coming company at the time when we did UserFox. So you know that you have to jump on this and do some kind of a sales thing. And this is where we didn't have a good solution. Like, we were looking at Salesforce. Obviously, a lot of people use it. It looks like a terrible piece of software, but it's actually very powerful.
Yeah.
But for something like us at the time, it didn't suit us. It was too expensive. It was too hard to set up, and it didn't fit within our culture in some regard. And but we still had this need of, like, we all had ideas to like pursue leads, and we wanted to stack a funnel, and we wanted to execute a sales plan against those leads. And there was nothing really out there that was great. So I kind of thought about it. I toyed around with some with some mock ops at the time after we sold User Fox. But then I decided not to pursue it at the time because I felt like I just don't know enough about the space.
Hmm.
And then the next company I did after that took off a lot. So the next company went from basically no sales to a sales machine and closing a B round. And it was just a very different experience. It was very enterprise, and you got to see the other end of a sales organization, a high enterprise, high touch, high volume sales machine.
Yeah.
And they use Salesforce. And I thought it was interesting to see how they set up Salesforce. It took months. We had to pay a consultant to come in and do it for us. And after, I think, a year or so, they tried to migrate away from Salesforce because they were not happy. But it ultimately ended up back on Salesforce because other solutions weren't flexible.
Okay.
So I thought this is something that probably has room for another player that is, you know, just kind of unopinionated, easy to use, and powerful.
Yeah, yeah. So who are the kind of target customers for Ivy Leads? Is it the kind of smaller, medium-sized businesses with a sales force that, you know, maybe slightly smaller in size than a company looking at using something like Salesforce?
Yeah, so right now we are focused on smaller companies. It works really well right now for agencies, actually. That's why we're doing a lot of stuff in Dallas, Texas right now. There, it's an agency town. There's a lot of smaller creative agencies, digital agencies that have sales pipes and not a lot of time to spend with a tool. So they're successfully using Ivy Leads to discover new leads, track them, and then have, you know, maybe one or two sales guys work the pipe, and that works out really great for them. They mm-hmm. they love the ease of the UI, the easy to use interface, because that's not their main jam, right? Like they have very different needs than like a professional enterprise that's trying to sell nonstop on the phone. They're basically in and out twice or three times a day, where they stack a funnel, they check up on what's going on in the lead, and assign some stuff, and then and they're back tomorrow, right? So it's a lot less time they want to spend around their sales pipe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So from a sales perspective, what kind of metrics and KPIs are important to a SaaS business, do you think, or what do you guys use? Or what do you see that your customers need in the app?
It's actually pretty similar to what Chartmogul kind of offers. Not as much around like MRR and stuff like that. You look at like a win ratio, like how many of your leads do you close? Like, is it 30%? Is it 60%? Like, how well do you do? And that kind of gives you a great indication of like, do you actually stack the right leads in your funnel? Like maybe you should not try for Fortune 500s yet. Maybe you need to go for mom and pop if that's where you win the most.
Mm-hmm.
And then where we're similar to you guys, for instance, is like we calculate an average deal value, which kind of lets you know what your deal sizes are. You know, is it in the hundreds? Is it in the thousands? Is it in the 100K?
Yeah.
And what we can track is like how long does it take for you to close your lead? Like, what is the average time that you need to invest, which kind of then helps you on your biz dev front, where you can kind of predict like, okay, we've got this new lead coming in. It's very similar to previous lead A and B. And it took us about, you know, 3 months to close that deal. So we will probably expect this to be around 3 months for this one as well.
Hmm. Okay, that's interesting. Do you think, so you obviously have quite a good window into the world of SaaS sales with mm-hmm. with your customers. Do you think that space is changing? Is the way that you sell a SaaS product today and the way that it will be tomorrow very different to, you know, how it was a few years ago?
Yeah, future predictions are hard, but... I definitely think there's something cooking in the sales space. I think 2016, you're going to see a lot of talk around the sales stack. And to me, it feels a lot like the early days of the smartphone, where you had a lot of a lot of stuff going on, but nobody really got it right. If you look at some really well done sales stacks these days, they use a lot of tools. So they are usually on a Salesforce, and then they add like 5 to 10 other tools that will help their outbound, and they help their inbound, and then they help this and that.
Yeah.
I think it's very hard to keep track of all these systems. So I think we're going to see something that makes it a little bit more unified. And I think there's a lot of stuff that we personally explore, not to give away too much, but I think there's a lot of stuff that needs to happen around anticipatory stuff. There's a lot of data come in. If you have a lot of signups, like think about a Zendesk, they have a lot of signups every day, but a system needs to be in place that kind of hints you towards the right leads that need more handholding. Because I think SaaS is stuff that self-serves. So a lot of customers come in, they sign up, they will convert on their own. You don't need to do anything. But then there's customers that come in and you need to know right up front that you need to prepare a sales pitch for them. You need to probably give a demo and then, you know, have a system in place that will let you know, hey, you got to pay attention here.
Yeah, yeah. And I guess that's one of the big positives with a SaaS model is that, you know, everything is kind of much more, in a way, predictable and measurable. So it's much easier to build systems around that kind of cater to that model. It's interesting how you kind of indicate that the fact that a lot of sales stacks are fragmented right now, but might need to move to something more kind of, like perhaps an aggregation of different services. But I don't know, to me that sounds like, you've got your monolithic systems like Salesforce that are on the one end, and then you have like these big sales stacks, incorporating a ton of different systems. It seems like we almost kind of bounce between one end and the other. I don't know whether these things just go around in circles, but it seems like at the moment, like you said, that a lot of people use a fairly complex stack of different tools for their sales machine.
Yeah, I was talking to this VP of sales the other day. I don't want to name the company, but I kind of asked him, it's like, hey, with all these tools, how much do you spend? Like, obviously you have money allocated towards Salesforce every month or annually, and then all these little one-off SaaS apps, like how much do you set aside for this? And he told me that for each rep he hires, he basically calculates in $500 a month on SaaS services, and then kind of lets that sales rep dictate what he needs to get his job done. You know, that I thought that was an interesting number to throw around. You know?
I guess you could see something like that as quite a personal thing as well. Like almost each person having their own preferred stack. It's becoming much more definitely fragmented, but I don't know if that's a good thing.
Yeah. I think that's what we're going to see play out in 2016 to see where this goes. You know, are people going to get tired of this fragmentation, or is, you know, some stuff going to fall off and group into one thing? Like a really good example is, like, you see this you see this everywhere right now. There's this SaaS app that will let you schedule a meeting, right? Like, instead of the back and forth via email, there's a solution that will send a link, you get to see a calendar of some person, and you get to pick a time. Mm-hmm. And there's like five or so solutions out there to do this. And I think that's what we're going to see just group into other products, right? Like, for me, that's definitely a feature rather than a product.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes sense. I want to just jump quickly, because we're running out of time a little bit, but I know with your background in design as well, how you think about designing a user experience for a SaaS product, and whether the SaaS business model itself, like, has an impact on design, whether those two things are linked at all, or I don't know, perhaps a web app is a web app, but definitely around like the onboarding experience. We've put together some content over the last few weeks around SaaS onboarding, which I think in general on the enterprise side is kind of pretty bad in some cases. How can we use design to kind of improve the user experience for a SaaS product?
Yeah, like when it comes to SaaS, like the one thing that I always noticed is that when you do enterprise software, it always had to struggle with adding one more feature, right? So in a SaaS, it moves really fast. Like you probably push out once a week or maybe even daily. So that's why so many of the UIs suck. It's quite difficult to keep product design consistently good.
Yeah.
You know, you might even start out with a UI that's clear and easy to use, but especially when things take off, you know, and you have a lot of work to do, it is quite a challenge to keep up with, you know, new features and things you designed a certain way in the early days, you know, might be giving you a hard time now that you have more stuff on your hand. So, like some advice that I always give, when people ask me about this is like, when you set out to build a new SaaS app or you're still in the early days, let's say you're pre-traction, like you should expect this to happen. Like you should expect that at some point you are smarter than you are now. You know about more features than you know about now. And then just to account for some time to make it proper, you know, to really allow this, or you're going to end up in 3 years down the road with a terrible looking UI, you know, where there's one more button and there's one more flow that isn't right. And, you know, to some extent, you know, no harm, no foul, like go ahead and just push something out and try it, but don't do it too many times. You know, at some point you've got to really take that time to design things. And that might mean that you have to, you know, remodel the home.
Yeah. Yeah. I think people are waking up to the concept of good user experience in enterprise apps. And I think there's obviously a few guys that are leading that. I mean, everybody uses Slack as an example right now, but I think they showed the world that everybody does care about a great experience, regardless of whether they're like an enterprise customer or consumer. I guess going back to that thing of kind of this fragmented SaaS world, you know, in theory, if there's a SaaS product that does one small thing, it should be able to do that one small thing fairly well in a well-designed way. Mm-hmm. I guess a huge monolithic product like Salesforce is a totally different kettle of fish when it comes to, you know, designing a consistent UX, when there's just so many different use cases and target users and other things.
Yeah.
But what's your pet peeve that you see in SaaS products right now? What's your like major gripe that really bugs you?
Like design wise?
Yeah, design wise.
Like it really irks me when people use different sets of fonts. Like it's something so simple to get right, you know, but they will start out, you know, the menu will have a font that might be, you know, Helvetica, and then they will toy around with Roboto in some other area. So it's like, just stick to one font. It's very easy. Like go into your CSS file right now and just put one font in there and delete everything else.
Yeah.
That's the one very easy thing to do.
That's great. We got it. The tip of the day then, just use a single font. Awesome. Cool. So we're kind of out of time, but I'm sure there's many more things that we could chat about. But is there anything before we go that you'd like to communicate, or I don't know if you guys are hiring right now or anything?
No, we're a pretty compact team. We're about four people right now. We are running self-funded at the moment. So I put some of my own money into this company. So we are trying to be lean until we hit a certain point, and then we might consider getting some funds and, you know, maybe relocate the company to frosty Berlin. I don't know.
Okay. One thing I was going to ask, actually, do you look back here to Europe, and would you ever consider making that move back?
Yeah, absolutely. Of course, you know, you're always going to be a German boy if you grew up there. And but man, like the energy in San Francisco is just incredible. But there's definitely right now a time, to be honest. I mean, I spent like 5 or 6 years in San Francisco now. It's a time right now where it's okay to be away. Like I spend a lot of time right now in Dallas because we have some family here. And Dallas is a very enterprise town. Like there's a big businesses here, a lot of Fortune 500s and very serious businessmen, which is the total opposite of San Francisco.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, I think it's very exciting at some point to go and explore other tech hubs. And to me personally, Berlin is the number two in the world. Like, I don't think London's got anything on Berlin.
Okay. Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, I see a lot of good design coming out of Berlin too. Like, most of the really interesting design concepts are usually consumer apps from Berlin.
Yeah, I think it's one of the strong points actually is the number of creative people here combined with technology. It's a good mashup of kind of creatives and techies.
Exactly.
And the beer is still cheap, you know, so.
That's true. And you have nobody's competing industry-wise. Like, there is no other industry in Berlin. So yeah. the startup industry can take over.
Yeah, no, it's true. I think it's going to be an interesting kind of two years or so to see what happens here. I think things are hotting up a little bit, definitely.
Yeah, you guys are in a good spot.
Cool. Awesome. Well, Bjorn, thanks for taking the time to chat. It's been really good. And yeah, I'm sure there's still a ton of things that we could talk about. Maybe at some point we'll have to do like a part two or something.
Yeah, sounds good. I really enjoyed this.
Cool. Awesome. Well, yeah, have a good day. And thanks again.